Thank you. First of all, thank you the group for letting me to visit the institute, and thank you the seminar for letting me speak about our work. So the title of the talk is Asymptotic Symmetries and Phase-Space Extensions. I know it's a lot of big words for one title, but in the introduction we are going to speak a little bit about these concepts, and then talk about our work in gravity regarding the extensions of these symmetries. And if time allows it, I want to talk about extensions in Young Mills and what have we done regarding that front. And finally, some outlook to talk about open questions and future directions. So, the idea of symmetries as a bridge between the classical and the quantum theory is an older one, like ever since the birth of quantum theory. And the idea is, okay, if you have your classical theory, you have all your stuff, your Poisson structure, your Church algebra, etc., the symmetries kind of connect one world to the other via certain objects. So, for example, in our case, it will be the symmetries of the S matrix that will connect certain properties of the Church algebra to the S matrix, and you have also some theorems, etc. But we can talk about an example, a non-trivial example, about this connection between the classical and the quantum via the symmetries, which is a known one, which is cylindrically symmetric gravity. So, cylindrically symmetric gravity can be reduced from 4D to 2D to have a non-linear sigma model, where it depends on the dilaton, which is rho, sigma, the conformal factor, and B is a SHUR matrix value function, okay? So that sigma model can be quantized, okay, in principle, due to its multiple properties, among them integrability, which is kind of the strongest property. But nevertheless, if we have this sigma model, we can compute on free data, okay? Free data, I mean, if you have two sheets, null sheets, that intersect on a spatial surface here, the data, free data, is the dilaton and the conformal factor at the surface, and you have also the value of this SHUR matrix on both null sheets. So you can compute the Poisson structure, you can compute the brackets, okay? And the idea is, okay, we want to quantize this system. And it has been done because, thanks to the integrability, you can take a definition of a deform connection that justify, okay, this hat, little hat there, and define the quantity that is known as the monodromy matrix, which was defined by Brittingall and Mason. And this matrix, okay, lives in the loop group of SHUR. And the Geroch group, which was found by Geroch when studying this cylindrically symmetric gravity, the Geroch group acts transitively, and it has this remarkable simple expression when we take the monodromy matrix. So we are in the presence of a symmetry of the problem. We have a transitive action of a group. And the idea was, okay, we have this symmetry. Korotkin, Nikolai, Sandleve proposed that once you quantize... Oh, yeah, I was... It's better this way. There? Yeah. Once you quantize the monodromy matrix, it gives you a really complex structure, is the double Youngian. But they conjecturize that you can obtain a quantum version of the Geroch group just by watching this form and taking as an ansatz in the exchange relationship of the quantization for the matrix element of M. And it has been done, like with Miguel Paternina and Michael Reisenberger, we proved that indeed, if you take the exchange relationship for the quantization of the monodromy matrix, you can obtain a quantum version of the Geroch group. So what is the main point here? That you start with a symmetry of the phase space in the classical world, then by some means you obtain the quantization, or you obtain some guidance through the quantization, and then you can export certain structure from the groups of symmetry to the quantum world. Okay, and there's this history hasn't ended yet. A month ago, Petropoulos and collaborators published some connection between the Ehlers group and the Carolean formalism. That it was
nice. What do you mean? Do they have found this symmetry in an asymptotic setting, or
Petropoulos? They established a connection between the asymptotic symmetries and the Ehlers group. The Ehlers group, like in the reduction of the theory of gravity. Okay, so that was the story when we have the cylindrically symmetric gravity, which of course we have like a super powerful tool, which is the integrability. But in general, we don't have that. So what do we have? Well, we have that the gauge is upgrading to new degrees of freedom in certain sense. What does it mean? Okay, so if we have asymptotically flat spacetimes, the VMS group acts on them, okay, and the VMS group is formed by all the residual gauge that lives after you partially fix the gauge by taking the bounding coordinates. So this gauge upgrading to new degrees of freedom is what we are left of. And that's kind of the method we are trying to understand. And it has been known ever since many years ago that the boundaries and the corners are essential to study the conserved quantities that come in from the residual gauge. So this is kind of the draw that we can encounter, like, for example, in Laurent paper and in recent years more often, that we have a Cauchy slice, we have two sheets here, and we have the corner. And the charges are going to live in this corner here, okay? And by boundary, I mean the null boundary of this Cauchy level. In our case, since we are working in the asymptotic region, we are working with the null infinity as the boundary. And as Penrose eloquently poses in his early 60s paper, null infinity is a good place to study the S matrix and the scattering properties of radiation. Okay, and also gives a nice definition for asymptotically flat spaces. Regarding the conserved quantities that live in the corner, we have several extensions and generalizations of the neural theorem, either due to Wall, due to Varnik, Brand, Henault, Ear, that they show that the conserved quantities comes in a codimension two forms. And this codimension two forms carries the charges. So for example, Maxwell, okay, this is the usual example. We have also gravity when we have a Killing field, okay? You can actually compute, integrate the charge, and it gives you the famous Comar charge. And in general, of course, we are dealing with gravity in general, you cannot integrate, it's a infinitesimal charge, which is called the Ear Wall two form, given by this ugly expression. Okay. So these are examples of these charges that live in the corner, and that contains a lot of information about the theory. Okay, so what's our main guidance through these extensions and asymptotic symmetries? In the case of cylindrically symmetric gravity, we have integrability as a main lighthouse, okay, where we can guide ourselves. But in general, there is no such thing. But thanks to the seminal work by Strominger, he proved that the VMS group forms a symmetry of the ACE matrix for scattering in the case of gravity. And this symmetry comes in this way, which resembles a conservation law. And this conservation law was shown that can be written as a world identity, which in turn corresponds to a Weyl-Mersov theorem for gravitons. So two worlds have been connected. one in the symmetry, in the asymptotic symmetry part, and the other one in the soft theorem world. And the same happens with Young-Mills. So these soft theorems became now like a guidance in the pursuit of charge expression, for example. The soft theorems gives you some charge, some candidate for a charge, and then you try to make sense of that candidate. Here is schematically what do we mean by soft theorem. And thanks to these works done by Strominger, Pasterski, Raclerieu, etc., and all collaborators, you have that the soft theorems correspond to conserved quantities. The question is, okay, if I can go further down the line of sub n soft theorems, would that imply new symmetries, what that charges would be, etc. Can you make sense of those charges geometrically in the phase space, classical phase space? And the answer is, yes, you can do a lot of stuff, and please do not take this as a complete bibliographical recount of the area. It's just a few works that kind of fit together the situation. So we have soft theorems. We have graviton soft theorem or photon soft theorem. They correspond to the known Astigal-Strubel charges, and then in the Young-Mills side, they correspond to the charges given by Strominger, okay? And if you go one step below to the subleading theorem, a soft theorem, then these charges that they give you, they correspond to the charges associated to the GVMS, which is the generalized VMS proposed by Miguel and Alok, and also to the extended VVMS given by Barnett and Tresor. And in the other side, you can actually use the expression of the charges given by Lissow, Pasterki, and Strominger. And you can go further down to the sub 2 leading soft theorem, which in the gravity case should be the expression found by Laurent, D'Agelli, and Raclerieu. And well, there are a lot of stuff going on around which needs to be clarified still. Which are the charges corresponding to the sub-n leading theorems?
Javier?
Yeah.
All right. What's I don't remember the paper by Hamad and Shiu. So what is the sub-n soft theorem for?
The sub-n is that you take n soft photons and take the limit under certain hypotheses and take the limit of the energy going to zero.
So okay, so it's exactly the same picture. Instead of having one, two, etc.,
yeah.
I have n soft insertion and I have hard matter nonetheless, right? So it's just about it's the same picture. It's not something.
It's the same picture, yeah.
Okay. And okay. Thank you.
And Miguel and Alok have found that if you take this result by Hamad and Shiu, you take the charges that they found, you can actually make sense of them classically. Like there's a correspondence between the classical and given by Hamad and Shiu. Okay, so the question that we want to pursue is, first of all, what is the classical meaning of these charges? Because, I mean, there is some expression, where it comes from. And the other thing is that this philosophy of more symmetries is equal to a relaxation of the asymptotic conditions. It has to be understood if it is something that you put ad hoc or it is a necessity of the theory. Okay, so you can make sense of it geometrically, which is the third part here, which is trying to understand geometrically and systematize this phase space extension. Because at the end of the day, we are in a classical theory, we have our symplectic geometry, and we want to understand in a clear and simple way these charges and this structure. Okay, so the first thing is the extensions in gravity. Okay, so in gravity we have this group, the generalized VMS, which is an extension of the VMS such that it contains the charges that come from the sub-leading soft graviton theorems. And we wanted with Miguel to provide a phase space where the superrotations and the supertranslations are canonical. In the beginning, the superrotations didn't act canonically, so we had to kind of put an extra term, boundary term, that fits all together. But we want to know if that term can be understood in a more geometric way. So this is a work in progress, so we want to understand if this extension that we provided earlier can be understood in the covariant phase space formats. So I'm going to show you some preliminary results regarding that. So that we are all on the same page, let me just go through this. We are using Bondi coordinates. Okay, this is the usual radiative data. The shear of a bundle of non-geodesics reaching an infinity contains a linear here term, which in the usual case of Ashtekar Trouble, this linear term vanishes, but we are considering this. This is the shear, and this is the Gerhoff tensor, which we are going to talk about a little bit now. And here is null infinity and null infinity plus minus. So, in this pursuit of enlargement of the BMS group, there are two kinds of proposals. One of the proposals was done by Barnig and Tresser. They use meromorphic functions, so they have poles, okay, in the celestial sphere, which also correspond to having also poles in the supertranslations. Miguel and Alok opted for a more regular extension, which is the diffs2 times the supertranslations, and this extension is more adapted to the concept of the extended corner symmetry. So that's why we prefer this one instead of that one, but it's just a matter of choice. The different thing with the diffs2 in the case of usual BMS is that you no longer have the asymptotically killing fields, but now you have this condition asymptotically, which means that the volume form of the celestial field remains constant, but the metric can change. So that leads you to the problem. If you allow this group to act, now the celestial metric starts to change. So you have now an extra degree of freedom. You have a new dynamical variable because the metric in the celestial field sphere is no longer fixed. And how can you see that? Okay, so if we go to the diffeomorphism preserving the gauge, we can split it like in the diffs2, the supertranslation, and the while, which is fixed by the diffs2. So the variation of the metric given by a B, which is a diffs2, gives you that. And if this is zero, okay, you have a conformal killing field, nothing new, and you obtain exactly the same as Ashtekar's Trouble. But if it is not zero, then you have this dynamics of the celestial sphere metric. How to deal with that? So, the idea we have was, okay, just for each one of the allowed metrics, yeah, you have this metric that is moving, for each one of these metrics, take a subphase space called gamma q, which satisfies this condition. So each one of these fibers is a phase space compatible with the Ashtekar-Struble phase space, each one for each metric. And now you take the bundle of them, and you have a larger phase space. How to parameterize this metric? Well, there is a nice way to parameterize due to compare Fiorucci-Rusiconi, who used it, but it was since the beginning that Gerhoff presented it, which is that you take the Gerhoff tensor and construct a potential for it. So this potential allows you to parameterize the metrics for this bundle of phase spaces. And on that phase space, we are going to construct this symplectic structure. So, starting from the charges, we have the supermomentum given by Ashtekar-Struble, and we have the superangular momentum, which was proposed by Barnig-Tresser and also by Miguel and Alok, which here we have the hard part, hard because it is quadratic in C, and we have here the soft part. The soft part, as you can see, contains these extra terms which vanishes in the case of the standard.
What was that, alpha again?
Yeah, alpha is the. Let me. Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah. Alpha is the divergence.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Of the. Yeah. So if we are in the common EMS, this alpha can be like absorbed here and really find the shift, the shear to contain that part. Well, those are the charges, but as I said, they were acting in a non-canonical manner because they don't satisfy the usual thing that we want for a canonical action to have. So we have this inequality. Since we are dealing with the minimum possible hypothesis, we wanted that these charges act canonically. So we looked for things to add to the angular momentum. And miraculously, it worked, because if you compute the variation of the superangular momentum due to a supertranslation, it gives you the right answer plus an extra term. And this term is a boundary term, which you can take to redefine the notion of the superangular momentum and have this new definition, which now everything closes. We were happy back then because, okay, we obtained a canonical action, but we wanted to see if we can make something about it. Like, what's the meaning of this term?
Sorry, the old one. Sorry, the P V. Can you show me the previous slide? Sorry, sorry, I'm confused. So the P V. What is? That's the canonical. Okay. That's the.
Yeah, this is like the supermomentum for this function.
Okay. You redefine the J in the order that it closes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We found the extra term that makes everything close. The Poisson algebra to close.
What is Javier, the relationship between that extra term and the fluxes?
Yeah, good question. As you can see here, this term is an integral over sky plus. And this term is an integral in the boundary. But, I mean, you have all these things going on, which makes that, in the end, it is a boundary term regarding the fluxes. I don't know if that answers the question.
Sure. But if you go back to zero fluxes and you restrict to, say, Barnich-Trussard, does it go to zero, the extra term that you have, or is it still there?
Oh, so yeah, this new term vanishes for the conformal Killing fields, but doesn't
local.
Vanish. No?
Local or global CKVs? Local, Barnich-Trussard.
Global CKVs. These are all defined global.
No, I mean, does it vanishes for BMS or for extended BMS?
It vanishes for BMS. It doesn't vanish for the extension, nor for Barnich stressor, nor for us.
Ah, okay. Thanks. Thank you.
And related to that question, you see that we have to deal with the kernel of this operator. And the kernel of this operator is constructed from this expression, which is non-local. But
can you interpret this extra term from like a purely charge computation a la Ayerwald? The way it was derived in Barnich-Trussard is that they compute Ayerwald charges and they got an answer and after they shuffle it and they try to make sense of that and after you have all the construction after that. My question is like the extra term you have with the three half alphas and can you interpret it coming from Ayerwald kind of prescription for the charge? Or like you guessed this term or you...
We didn't guess it. Like we
that
just...
appeared and...
Yeah, it appeared like naturally.
And can you reinterpret it coming from a charge computation?
It would be nice to see the higher world and see this is the term.
Okay.
It's coming from here. Yeah. But it's just, you compute this guy and it gives you this.
Yeah, okay.
Just like that.
You need to go beyond higher world because you need to renormalize first.
So yeah, but like you have the ambiguity,
Sure.
But after renormalization, yeah, it would be nice to
have like, an ambiguity of fixing which prescription.
Because after all the ambiguities, that comes from this kernel, these ambiguities were resolved by taking the S-matrix world identities and saying, okay, any linear term spoils the world identity for this matrix, and higher powers spoil the non-locality, so we leave it like that. But it is nice, anyways, that it satisfies this kind of split. So if you take the Poisson bracket of two hard, it gives you a hard piece, then the soft part gives you the soft, and the boundary, this boundary. So it kind of screams that it is...
Maybe I have a question about that, because in the naive setting, well, you wrote the soft part. The soft part is some integral of n, and it commutes with itself. Can you comment? So usually the soft part of the charge commutes with the soft part of the charge. Mm-hmm. But here it does not.
It would be interesting.
Right, because the soft part of the charge is proportional to the creation operator. And the creation operator commutes with the creation operator. So do you have a kind of understanding or conceptual understanding? What does it mean? Why it doesn't commute anymore? Is it like... It's completely different from the usual picture of soft graviton, where the soft graviton are independent of the background, are independent of... right, so therefore they commute in each other.
Exactly. But we still don't have any...
So that's the result you have, is that separately, and it's not okay, because it doesn't have to be, right?
Yeah. In the beginning, like you can have like any mixture here, whatever, but nicely separate.
Okay, because the only thing that does to satisfy the algebra is the total charge. Okay.
And so far so good. We have this extra term, but. We have to make sense in terms of the extended phase space. So again, minimally taken hypothesis, okay, we get the symplectic form to satisfy these minimal things, okay, which at each fiber you have the Ashtagar-Struble symplectic form, and just from those hypotheses you can actually construct the symplectic form in this way, where you have. The symplectic form on straight glass and the symplectic form on the columns. And you can see that you have this behavior in delta Q. So if delta Q is zero, then you do not have that part. And, okay, it seems like a Karl-Maschig trick that up your sleeve and magically you have this term, but one would like to connect this result with the extended corner symmetry studies. Okay, so the idea is, okay, let's start from the scratch and say you have a boundary and you have a metric there, you have a field that now behaves as a new degree of freedom, now has dynamics, which is the metric of the celestial field. So this work has been done several from like at least 8 years ago with these groups. And it was about to take at finite distance a corner C, yeah, which is the boundary of this null sheet, and see what happens with the gravitational symmetries there. So the question that was trying to answer was, how can the gravitational symmetry be decomposed? Okay, and when you have this kind of corners, you can move it around. Okay, so you have any diffeomorphism that moves it around, but you want to kind of classify what happens with the diffeomorphism. So infinitesimally, you have a point and you are moving it by an infinitesimal vector. And you have all this group that acts on the corner. But if you take a perspective of the embedding map, then you have a fix set here, which can be like an interval times S2, and you embed it, and the embedded map now is the one that contains the dynamical information. So the points are fixed, this orange point are fixed, but you are adding now an extra vector which contains the dynamical information. Okay, so this is kind of 300 years old, the idea that of an embedded map, but when you try to understand what happens with the dynamics of the field in terms of the symplectic structure, it is really nice how it is clearly shows you how the symmetries work. In our case, we are not taking finite distance in the bulk, we are taking it all the way to null infinity. So this huge group kind of collapses into the usual stuff, which is the DFS2, the Weyl part, and the super translation. Okay? So, how to do these computations? Well, we are going to kind of try to reveal this extra term in a more geometrical way. You take the embedding map, which goes from the solution set to the embeddings. Okay, so for each solution, you have an embedding map. And together with it, you have a vector field which generates diffeomorphisms. Okay, so for each embedding, you have a vector field that is telling you, okay, the metric is moving that way. And of course, there is a lot of formal machinery behind it. But schematically, one can think about this vector field as a Maurer-Cartan form for the embedding map. Okay, and it satisfies this condition. So if you have a diffeomorphism, okay, generated by a vector V, then it is related with its counterpart in the solution space as a vector field in solution space by this way. Okay, and the way to compute these things is this guy, this equation. So a variation with the pullback of the embedded map does not commute. It gives you an extra term given by this lead derivative, which, again, there are a lot of things going on behind, but just try to remember that this is just a glorified version of the fundamental theory of calculus. Okay, it's just moving a derivative inside the integral. And this object here allows one to formally compute all the integrals when you are dressing the field. So the idea is to use the usual action, you take the Lagrangian, you have the field, but you don't put the field, the original field, you put the dress field there inside. Okay? And here there are two kind of conventions. One is you dress the Lagrangian, or first you compute the dressing and then you compute the Lagrangian. There are two conventions. They differ by a boundary term, which, no surprise, similar to that one. And the idea is, okay, we have these two conventions, let's say what happens with the symplectic form. So we already have the Lagrangian, let's see what happens with the symplectic form, the symplectic potential, etc. Okay, any questions? Great, so let's see what happens. So, the symplectic potential, the covariant one that we are calling, is this one. Okay, it's given by this expression, which, again, this is kind of the usual stuff, okay, which comes from the renormalization of the gravitational symplectic potential. And now you have these extra two terms, which, of course, in gravity, this one vanishes. And then you can take, again, the exterior derivative and take the symplectic form, and you obtain this nice expression, which contains a lot of stuff. Here we have the usual symplectic form, but here we have this boundary term, okay, which again in gravity this vanishes, and we have this term which accounts for non-integrability usually, and this extra term with Q, the another charge. So, now that we have all this structure, one would like to compute whether this is the same as we get with Miguel before. Okay, so that's kind of the natural question. We have all this formalism, all this machinery. Let's see if it gives the same as we obtain with the minimal hypothesis. How to compare it? Because it is kind of messy. Like each term can be integrated by part and give you a lot of stuff. But what to do? Okay, so just take two sphere diffeomorphisms and contract them with the covariant symplectic form. And if you obtain the superangular momentum, then yeah, it's okay. Well, that was what I did. So the first term here, kind of a famous term, because it appears everywhere. It appears in Ashtekar Struvel, it appears in the paper by Pompeo and company. And in our case, we killed it by taking the boundary conditions. Sorry, go off. By taking the boundary conditions sufficiently stronger, like a little bit stronger, and it vanishes. And the second term is interesting because this term gives you the exterior, solution space Lie derivative minus the space-time Lie derivative. And this guy has a name, and it's the anomaly operator. This anomaly operator, when evaluated in the...
Sorry, which boundary condition are you taking? Like, are you just killing the radiation, or you do something more subtle?
Sorry?
Are you, what are, like, the first line?
Yeah. What is the boundary condition, Jessica? What is the boundary condition for the N U?
For the shear?
Yeah, so...
Write it on the blackboard. What is it?
Oh, yeah, it was written before.
Sorry. Ah, okay, so the when you approach special infinity, it has to decay sufficiently enough.
Yeah. If you take this one out, then it is spoiled.
Yeah.
Non-integrability. But that non-integrability, this one.
So you're in the.
It's under control.
Yeah.
It is not. So we put this little epsilon here that seems like no big deal, but it helps you to clean the expression. And then, this anomaly operator, it is interesting because it made this connection with the works of Laurent and Olivieri and Daniele Anthony. And one can compute this anomaly operator on the Noether charge, and it gives you like exactly this guy, completely, which is the boundary term here is the Lie bracket between these two vectors, contracted with the Hawking-Perry Strominger superangular momentum, the hard part, and that's important, the hard part, plus the soft term, the same soft term that we have. And this expression is nice because it is exactly this expression for our superangular momentum. So I know that maybe it's a little messy, but the thing is, if you start with the covariant phase-based formalism, you compute this covariant symplectic form, you contract it with two diffeomorphism generators on the sphere, and you obtain this expression, which independently we show that is equal to the angular momentum that we had previously. So the two things are the same, and it is nice to remember that this definition for the angular momentum aspect is kind of the most covariant thing that you can do with the Riemann tensor at hand. So it has like a nice definition in terms of the Riemann tensor. You can see it in this paper. So the two approaches kind of have this consistency. This was like a sanity check. Okay. So we have that for sure.
Does it work also for the translation?
Well, the translation, actually, we haven't done it. Because it's a work in progress, but I don't know. The super translation actually doesn't need. Sorry that I'm going backward, but I want to show you. Yeah, the super translation doesn't need any extra term. It is good as it is.
Yeah, but the embedding map formalism.
It has
non-zero. It's small.
Yeah.
The super translation moves the embedding. It changes the embedding.
Yes. It, you can see it here. Yeah, there. But yes, it is what to do.
So the prescription you have for the angular momentum, I'm a bit lost in everything. Is it the same as the one by Romain, Laura, and Kevin about like for Celestia that transform well under Celestial holography? Because there is like several prescriptions for the angular momentum.
Yeah.
So yours agree with which one?
Yeah, ours are really
they took them. So in their paper that they use there.
Yeah, yeah, okay,
their,
that's
and their, and their prescription is the same as the one of Daniele.
Okay, okay, that's why I'm asking. Yeah, but that's why
they use this property of soft commute with soft and
exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I was
I mean, right?
Yeah.
They started from
from
Javier's results.
Yeah, I mean, it is important here that we are remarking here that it is the hard part.
I mean, you have this soft part that you could integrate by part as you wish. But
yeah, essentially now. So before there was so-called ambiguity in angular momenta. Now it's whether
that's
you
why,
do it a la celestial or a symmetry or I mean whatever. It's like this unique prescription.
Okay, so I don't know how much time.
About 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay.
Javier, can I ask you a stupid question about vocabulary? Why do you call it covariant, the phase space? I mean, isn't that the extended phase space? Because it's kind of confusing, I think, for students, for instance, that you call it covariant. Or do you have a something in mind when you call it?
Yeah, I wrote covariant. Yeah, because I mean, you can make a lot of extensions. Okay, so, there is one kind of the extension which I call the covariant, but I mean, it's just a name. I won't bet hard on it.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, the unextended phase space is covariant also, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's more like this is the... but okay, I agree. Since you come from an extension that you have imposed just by consistency, you weren't sure that this was the extended phase space we were talking about,
that's
right?
That's right, because...
Okay, I see. Yeah. So that's why you call it covariant, but...
when we kind of crafty make this symplectic form, we didn't know if it is the right one, so now we call it covariant and we want to
see. Yeah, I was just too curious to see if you have something, some sublinear meaning.
Oh, yeah. No. But, I mean, it should be like a nice geometric description.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's all for the gravity part. I've done some work also in the Young-Mill part for the extensions, so let me recap that quite fast. So, as we saw in gravity, we have the subleading theorem correspond to this extension for the VMS. So what happens in general? Okay, so you are going to start having higher and higher large case transformation, order R, order R squared, etc. So a nice playground is the Young-Mills, where you can understand the higher order extension in nonlinear regimes. Okay, so this is I don't take the complex part term. This is the Young-Mills without the I harmonic gauge for the vector potential, and you run into two problems. Problem number one, same as gravity. If you allow a large phase transformation, which spoils your boundary conditions, then you have to try to enlarge the phase space, first thing. And second thing, if you take two order R large phase transformation, their commutator gives you an order R squared. So Young-Mills has this property that as soon as you put a cut order R to the power of n, you have to allow everything, because the commutators and everything start to pile up. So the solution is, okay, just let's see what happened at order one, quadratically killing everything from power two on, and let's see what happened there. And what we have is same idea. We compute the charges, which are those ones here. Okay, so we have initially the usual charge plus this extension, and this is the order one charge, which is non-local, okay? And this agree with the charges given by Lissot, Pasterky, and Strominger. And you can actually, again, by craftsmanship, let's call, compute the symplectic form that possess these two terms, okay? And the charge algebra closes and everything is nice. So this extension, when you cut up to the linear level, allows you to account for this extra charge, the order one. What happens with the order two? Well, that's an open question because you have to take into account not only the dressing of the field, but the dressing of the dressing of the field, and so on, and it starts to get messy. Yeah. So in the abelian theory, at least you can do it, because since it is linear, there is no problem that you can add as many large Lie transformations as you can. And the first step is to, okay, just take the extended phase space, dress it, like you get the radiated phase space, and you dress by these large Lie transformations, okay? You use the normalization of the splective potential due to Laurent, Hofmüller, and Rilo. And finally, you just compute the renormalized symplectic form. Then, once you have this renormalized symplectic form, okay, you can compute the charges, which coincide with the ones that were given by the soft theorems, okay, and you can also compute the dual charges and obtain like a hierarchy of central charges. But the main point here is that in Jack Mills, we can do it up to order one by cutting the linear level. In Maxwell, we can do it like no problem. We can make sense of all the charges. So I want to end by presenting like some preliminary work with Silvianaghi. But what happens beyond the linear level for Jack Mills? And the thing here is, okay, if you are going to dress Jack Mills linearly, okay, that's okay. But if you want to go one level higher, you start to get all these relations between order one, order zero, order one, order zero. So let's it is better to start from the scratch and say, okay, let's dress the field finitely. Like use a finite transformation, dress the field, and see what happens in a more restricted gauge. So what we use is a self-dual Jack-Mills in the Lightcone gauge. And imposing the bulk condition for the variation, we obtain a nice recursive formula for the variation of the dress field. So it's kind of the same. This is like the Jack-Mills part of the gravity that we were talking earlier. We have like the variation of the metric field regarding to a diffeomorphism. Now we have the variation of the dress field regarding some large case transformation. So here, this is just the first step towards the definition of the phase space, which is just how to compute the variation, just how to compute it up to all order. And this can be done recursively. It is you can verify that this is what we use with Miguel, and this should be the order two. Okay, so that this is like the main part. I don't know if you have any question.
I have just a comment. Unfortunately, I don't remember, but we can talk about it later, of course. It's just because I will forget. Try to talk with Rob because they are doing the extension, not with the embedding, but for Jack Mills. With a couple of students, and I think they are publishing this paper this week or next week, so it's almost ready. So you maybe you can be able to check immediately that it's like the same thing as for gravity, because here the fact is that they had to work a bit harder to get it because it's not from the embeddings that it comes, but there is a similar function that you can define in gauge theories that are not gravitational, and it works exactly as it works for gravity.
Oh, great.
So it should give you at least a top-down guiding principle here.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't remember all the details, but just before I forget.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it would be very nice to compare again.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. Because the more sanity checks that you do, the better. Because in this case, we start from the scratch. Like, you dress the thing and see what happens. Like, if you can recursively better, if you can't, okay. That's so some open questions and avenues to continue. So first of all, it would be nice to have the connection with the intrinsic the holography world. Okay, so this could in principle lead to new insights of a more general holographic correspondence in the case of asymptotically flat space times. And we also want to know whether these self-Savalidian theorems can be extended. Can be extended to the.
That was quick.
Yes, I put yes on this, but can I go to look for the cable?
Yeah, sure.
You can just say it on blackboard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, here are your conclusions.
So.
It's a dramatic end to your seminar.
No.
It's okay, on the side. Good.
Okay. So, first of all, it would be nice without this holography. So these charges can be understood in terms of their duals in the dual theory, or is there something to say about the connection with holography? Then there is the subject of the leading theorem that relates the order R diffeomorphisms with the charges. So some work has been done by Miguel and Alok, and they propose even charges in the case of gravitation coupled with matter. And it was also there are also charges proposed by Laurent and Danieli and Raclerieu, and it would be nice to see whether they coincide or it can be done a certain way. And then, what happens in more general context, like for example, black holes. So black holes, like regarding, one can say anything else regarding the symplectic structure of the near horizon geometry, or something like that. It would be nice to make some connection. So, these are kind of some of the directions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Javier. Question by student first. What is a huge. if not, question from anyone in the room.
I have a question. I'm surprised you didn't put that in your list, because now that you have developed some other notion of dressing at asymptotic infinity, then one of the motivations to do that is to go back to the central problem of the S-matrix, which is being able to define the S-matrix. And the reason it's hard to define the S-matrix is because of this, not only because of this infrared divergences, but because there's no understanding, proper understanding in the Fock space construction of what are the dressing operators and how to include them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you have new insights on that? Like, you know, can we finally reopen that thing and you know, go and define properly the S matrix?
Yeah, I think that it's still like, we are still like scrapping the surface.
Or do you know how you would go from where you are to there?
I don't see like, back in path, but it's like we are still like we have a baby in diapers still, like thing that we are scrapping the surface. And yeah, it would be nice, for example, the connection here at the subleading with the like a formal tool in the sense of the embedded map to give meaning to the thing that okay, you have the embedded map at finite distance, you can compute all the extended corner symmetry. What happens if you go to null infinity and still want to have the subleading charges? So that's kind of one of the questions that should be answered first, and then start to see whether you can extend to the S-matrix.
Another question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If not, let's thank Javier again.